Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, dragging you into my weird, wacky, and wonderful world once again as we go down the relentless rabbit hole that is the disappearance of Ray Grecar. For those who aren't familiar with the case, Ray was the district attorney of Centre County, Pennsylvania, who vanished without a trace on April 15, 2005, leaving a list of questions in his wake, all of which condensed to a single curiosity. Was his vanishing a result of foul play? Suicide? Or even stranger, was it voluntary? That's the three-pronged approach we'll take in examining the evidence, because this is a mystery where the puzzle pieces seem to fit regardless. So let's drag the riverbed and try to unearth the truth hidden below the surface, the clues that are stuck in mud, in order to garner greater specificity and clarity. Let's examine what is not said, what remains unspoken, and dissect that which is explicit in order to retrieve the other side of the coin, which is the implicit desires lurking beneath. But first, the basics. Ray Grecar was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1945, where he graduates from a Catholic school called Gilmore Academy. From there, he attends the University of Dayton, during which time he secures an internship with the local prosecutor, something that propels his career interests in the direction of attending law school. After earning a JD from Case Western, he takes a prosecutorial job for Cuyahoga County, specializing in murder and rape cases. By 1980, however, his life takes an unexpected twist. Ray is married to his first wife, who receives a job offer from Penn State University, which she accepts. The family moves to central Pennsylvania to accommodate, and Ray Grecar finds himself in an interesting position, as he agrees to be a stay-at-home dad and forego his career, at least over the short term. This type of situation became far more common during that era, satirized and dramatized exceptionally well by films such as Mr. Mom and Kramer vs. Kramer, where the follies of societal change were on hilarious and sometimes tragic display as men and women crossed the lines of domestic endeavors into the workforce and vice versa. But the result of those changes revealed the fact that many people with kids also wanted to work, regardless of gender, and both parents working essentially became the new norm rather than the exception. However, inflation adjusted upon the introduction of the two-income household, and parents who didn't intend to work were often forced to do so in order to accommodate high costs of living. With that being the case, Grecar's time at home taking care of his adopted young daughter is cut short by professional pursuits, this time in the form of an assistant DA position in Centre County. This doesn't last long, however, as the DA decides to not run for re-election in 1985, giving Ray the incentive he needs to try to earn the job. And he gets it. Not only that, but Ray Grecar will win the same election four times over, before announcing in 2005 that he won't seek to return after 20 years of service in that role. What I think is important for us to note, however, is that Ray will be divorced twice over by the time we reach 2005, and living with his girlfriend Patty at that time. The reason I mention this is to establish the fact that Ray wasn't required to pay either of those wives alimony. In the first marriage to Barbara, which lasted from 1969 to 1991, his wife made considerably more money than he did. His second marriage was from 1996 to 2001, yet I don't know the reason alimony wasn't awarded in that situation. These considerations come into play later, so keep them in mind as we work through the logistics of this disappearance. So, the DA position in Centre County is considered a part-time gig, but this is a fairly common designation in government or law enforcement that says pretty clearly you're going to be doing full-time work for part-time pay and limited benefits. But this position comes with a healthy pension, and by 1996, Ray is able to get the role changed to full-time. So in terms of a salary, this becomes a six-figure paycheck for Ray Grecar, with his compensation reaching in excess of $129,000 per year as he neared retirement in April 2005 before disappearing. That sum would be nearly $163,000 in today's money, which is a really nice salary, especially when placed in the context of the cost of living in central Pennsylvania. So, you'd think Ray Grecar had a little cash lying around somewhere, or investments, or at least a 401k to allow him retirement funds. But he doesn't. He has a 2004 Mini Cooper he bought with cash, and his house is in his girlfriend's name. Many people point to the fact he's due a nice pension upon retirement and wouldn't need savings to live. And that may very well be the truth, but he disappears before seeing so much as a dime of that money. Supposedly he had only a few $100 in the bank at the time of the vanishing, indicating that it would be generous to label him as living paycheck to paycheck. He was broke. But if you're waiting for me to tell you about his secret cocaine habit, the drinking, paying for sex, gambling, or any other type of wasteful spending, I'm not. For all intents and purposes, Ray Grecar seemed like a pretty conservative guy. He paid for his car in cash to avoid interest, and the car itself was fuel efficient. In fact, you might say that Ray was so frugal, he actually had no assets. He also had a reputation as a ladies' man, a charmer, but there's no indication he was involved in any sort of scandalous affair that would incite another party to take action against him. He kept to himself, and was described as intensely private. And that's what makes this mystery so compelling. This whole event is shrouded in secrecy, even in areas where the clues were left right out in the open. So let's get going with the timeline of April 15, 2005, the day Ray Grecar vanishes from the face of the earth, never to be seen again. Or was he? Some say differently. So, on this day, a Friday, Grecar is about 7 months away from retirement, planning to leave the DA position at the end of the year. He decides to call out of work that morning, telling people at the office that he plans to go shopping for antiques at stores in Lewisburg. And that's what happens. But Ray Grecar never comes home. Not that day, and not in more than 13 years since. So what happened to him? Well, at some point on Friday, Ray visited a row of antique shops, leaving his car parked outside in the lot at the time. We don't know if it moved to another location and back within that time frame, however. It could have sat there since the day before, or it could have been driven from that location to another before the vehicle was returned. But either way, by Saturday at 6 p.m., the cops discover the red 2004 Mini Cooper, acting upon a missing persons report filed by Ray's girlfriend Patty when he doesn't come home the day prior. Of course, if the DA disappears, it's going to garner a lot of interest from police. The chances of foul play increase in such a situation, given that Ray prosecutes dangerous criminals. Of course, so does the possibility for conspiracy theories arising, as numerous government agencies are likely to get involved and not offer any transparency. But this is what they find. The car doors are locked, and the keys are missing. Nobody is inside the vehicle. Yet Ray's cell phone is found inside. It's not much evidence to go on, so they keep looking. All the while, it's apparent the car's interior smells like cigarette smoke. And what's that lying on the floor? Right there on the passenger side. It's ash. Ray Grecar totally hated smoking. So why is there ash in the car? And why does it reek like smoke? We don't know. There's no sign of a struggle in the car, or even in the parking lot. But Ray was seen in the store that day, and it was also noted by one witness that he was with a woman. When pressed to identify the woman, the witness described somebody Ray knew well. But the police soon learned she was nowhere near that location at the time. So to this day, the woman remains a mystery, and we can't necessarily say she actually exists in the first place. She could be a piece in this puzzle. Or not. So we need to look beyond those factors, but not too far, because there's a bridge next to the parking lot where Ray's car was found, one with a river running below. Of course, there's not much significance to that fact, until I say that Ray's father killed himself. And while I don't know the method he utilized, in 1986, Ray's brother is also found dead by suicide, in a river, after jumping off a bridge. According to several sources, however, Ray claimed that he didn't believe his brother took his own life, citing that the man wouldn't orphan his two children like that. He suggested foul play was the root of his demise, but it wasn't proven. So authorities immediately believe it's a possibility Ray could have committed suicide. It seemed likely due to his family history, and his girlfriend claimed he'd been sleeping a lot prior to his disappearance, suggesting he might have been depressed. Yet this is just speculation. There's no note, no witnesses, and no body. That last element is the most important. His remains have never turned up. Other bodies have been recovered from that river in the past, but not his. In fact, most drowning victims' bodies surface or come ashore at some point due to a combination of biological and environmental factors. But Ray left nothing. Not a shoe or a watch. Not even his car keys. So he couldn't have gone in the water. Right? Well, not so fast. It turns out the water in this river is about 11.5 feet deep downstream, and the fiber nets that usually aren't installed by that time of the season have actually been placed early this year. The prevailing opinion seems to be that those nets could easily churn up his body, and there would be virtually no identifiable trace left of him on the other side. So that's plausible. It explains why his body would disappear. But this is somebody who's either prosecuted or attempted to prosecute everybody from a Hell's Angels member to murderers to drug dealers to now disgraced former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. Ray had some clout in the community, but he also squared off against some powerful people. The bottom line is this. Did somebody want Grecar dead? We don't know that. An informant once claimed a Hell's Angels member killed Ray as payback for a lengthy sentence received in relation to an aggravated assault charge. He claimed the body was thrown down a mineshaft, so the police take him there and ask him to lead the way. But he suddenly refuses to go any farther without cutting a deal for himself, whether the body is down there or not. The cops obviously know he's lying, and that lead goes nowhere. Beyond that, some have speculated there could be foul play related to information Ray had regarding what would become the biggest scandal in the history of Penn State University, in which Jerry Sandusky molested numerous boys between the ages of 11 and 15 over the course of his tenure with the team, specifically through a charity aimed at helping the kids. The fallout from it brought the school to its knees for a short time. So while it's water under the bridge now, no pun intended, at least for those who didn't suffer his wrath, what would have made it so sensitive at the time is one factor. Head football coach Joe Paterno knew it was happening. This guy was like God there. Penn State and Joe Paterno are synonymous. He was there for decades. He won the national championship and earned the nickname Joe Pa. He was a living legend. But he was also a man who had been told Sandusky molested children. And he ignored it. It cost him quite a bit in his final years on Earth, in terms of his reputation. But not until the truth came out. This was a secret for a long time. Apparently Ray Grecar interviewed Jerry Sandusky, felt he was guilty, and to keep a long story short, neglected to move forward due to lack of evidence. However, Sandusky admitted to showering with an underage boy and supposedly didn't deny that it turned him on. Of course, the scandal finally rocked the university in 2011, but it's difficult to say what Ray knew in 2005. Would his life be in danger? My opinion is this. That scandal was going to boil over with or without Ray Grecar. There were so many people involved, too many lives hurt for it to remain a secret. There were just so many victims in that case that could never be silenced. It seems as though putting any type of hit on Grecar would be a worthless solution. The evidence against Sandusky would remain the same. Plus, Grecar doesn't pursue Sandusky and they know he isn't seeking re-election. Some people have speculated Grekar might have been planning to go after Sandusky as his last hurrah, the final chance at glory. But we're talking about a guy who's retiring, turning 60, sleeping a lot, and browsing antique shops and watching baseball games instead of going to work. He behaves like a guy who's leaving office after 20 years of hard, stressful days, and there's just no evidence to suggest Sandusky, Paterno, or anybody affiliated with Penn State was involved in Ray Grekar's disappearance. So who killed him then? I mean, you'd think detectives would recover information from the hard drives on his computers, right? He had a home computer, and also a laptop used for work. So detectives check out Ray's computer at his house, and there are a few searches that catch their attention. Now, I don't know exactly when these searches were performed on Ray's computer, but reports say it was the night prior to his disappearance. Apparently, he searched for directions to Lewisburg, the area where he disappeared. But one of the searches was for how to wipe a hard drive, and another was how to fry a hard drive. Another search even asked if water would destroy a hard drive. Yet, Ray's home computer wasn't wiped. There was no attempt at destroying the hard drive. It's left as it was found. Which can only mean one thing. The laptop is what detectives really need to find. The secrets have to be on there. The answers. At the very least, a couple of clues. But it's nowhere to be found. Not at home. Not at the office. Not in his car. So, he must have gone through with destroying the hard drive, as he intended. Or maybe somebody else got to it first. Either way, it was pivotal to the investigation. Unfortunately, as advertised, the laptop was also underwater. A fisherman pulled it out of a local stream, long since rusted and caked in mud. But to the dismay of police, the hard drive was missing. It had been removed at some point, undoubtedly dropped in a far-off location nobody would ever suspect. Or not. Because the hard drive is later found upstream, and detectives acquire it. Sadly, the deteriorating hard drive prevented police from extracting information, but they were able to confirm they had Ray's laptop, and the hard drive appeared to be the one that was missing from it. So, the initial question becomes one like this. Why did somebody discard Ray's laptop, whether it was him or by way of foul play? And the focal point of that question asks what was on there he didn't want anyone else to see. Or if in fact he was murdered, what those people believed he had that they didn't want anyone else to see. Either way, we don't have that info. There isn't much to go on in this case. I wouldn't fault anybody for believing this was anything from suicide to murder to a voluntary disappearance. Yet, I think if we dig down a bit deeper, beneath the surface, we'll find a narrative forming that brings us closer to the truth. Instead of following evidence, we trace Ray's steps primarily by way of desire present in his actions. Now, there are times when it's questionable whether specific actions were taken by Ray, or if there was foul play, even to the extent of a conspiracy. So rather than playing that guessing game, let's try to extract the meaning inherent in the choices, regardless of who made them. By doing that, what we'll try to accomplish is identification of a pattern. So then the next step is to match the psychology of actions we specifically know were taken by Ray to those taken without explicit knowledge. The presence of an outside perpetrator should become clear with any disparity. So let's go back to the beginning, to the moment prior to this thing getting underway. It's a fact that Ray Grekar has no savings, no retirement fund, and perhaps no more than hundreds of dollars in his checking account. While he has a nice pension coming to him, he has still chosen to have no assets in his name. The car isn't even financed, which brings up a very interesting point. In fact, a tragedy. Ray pays cash for his 2004 Mini Cooper, and he buys it brand new. That generally suggests a person intends to drive the vehicle for a significant period of time. but Ray disappears in April 2005, having left the new car behind, in a situation where it could have been financed and abandoned if he knew he was leaving, saving thousands of dollars. Had Ray intended to disappear, wasting cash would have been awfully strange behavior, given that he was letting go of his pension, too. So what I see here is that Ray Grecar, upon buying the Mini Cooper, did not have plans to disappear on April 15th, 2005. Something changed. Let's see how it progresses. Now, obviously we don't have access to most details of the man's life, but we'll comb through the facts we know. Okay, the next thing to happen is Ray announces he's not going to run for DA after being elected 4 straight times. So, something changed to alter that pattern. The answer could be age, with Ray turning 60 that year, and the role of district attorney weighing on him after 2 decades. Regardless, he decides to leave. He isn't defeated in an election. What I see here is a need for detachment. Ray wants to get away. He's had enough and wants to isolate himself from that world. But remember this. He's kind of a big deal. He's been at this for 20 years. He loses that identity when he retires. Yet, who does he become then? What does Ray do when he retires? So many young people discuss retirement in the context of sitting back and enjoying yourself as you fade into old age and beyond. But the reality is that which you just retired from is no longer your identity. You have to find something else, but do so in an environment where you've just shut the door on a career. Sometimes people in high places struggle when they come down to earth. Let's just take account of Ray's activities and status. He announces he's not running for re-election, deciding to step away from his profession. He's turning 60, he has no retirement fund, no money saved, and supposedly also very little in his checking account. If you examine every person you know who's also in this situation, which is very common in America, even among prominent people, and ask yourself how many of them are in such a predicament intentionally as the result of being a traitorous spy from overseas, the answer is almost undoubtedly zero. People point to the fact he has nothing to show for his good salary as evidence he could be a spy. But there are so many other people in this country living that way. Though he does have a pension coming to him, he has no assets, he has no plans to marry his longtime girlfriend, and their house is in her name. He has no stated aspirations for his time in retirement. He has a brother who committed suicide, his father also committed suicide, he's been sleeping a lot, and he's taking days off to go on road trips, sometimes telling no one. Of course, the pension sticks out like a sore thumb in that list because it's a big positive in what is otherwise a list of risk factors and signs pointing to the end. But I think what's important to note about it is that the pension is earned by default of work already performed and ultimately paid with money to which he doesn't yet have access. So for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist at the time he disappears. Now, what all of this says is that Ray isn't making any future plans. Here's the most important factor in this entire disappearance. Notice that Ray offers his employer the courtesy of knowing he won't be coming back to run for re-election, but his family receives no such consideration before he disappears. Why would that be? He made plans to wipe his hard drive and also searched for a map of the area where he eventually disappeared before taking a day off work to drive to that place, ditching the laptop along the way. Well, if you remember, Ray said he didn't think his brother's death was a suicide, and specifically for the reason that the man wouldn't orphan his children. So what that says very clearly is that Ray thinks such is unacceptable, and he has that perspective because he's not in a place where he can relate emotionally. Yet. But that was 1986. The years go by, and their heritage suggests he's likely to be plagued by the same ills as his father and brother, who succumbed to such before him. So once he does, and desires to go the same way, we know he does so with the perception that it's unacceptable, especially in the context of family knowing. So what we see is that Ray disappears in a situation where there's doubt about how it happened and he's nowhere to be found again. Now, ask yourself this. What reason does Ray have to disappear? His daughter is grown. He's divorced and paying no alimony. He has a nice pension coming to him. His car is paid off. He just really doesn't have any baggage. He doesn't need to disappear to start a new life. He can just tell his girlfriend he's leaving. It's not like he hasn't had a breakup before. He's been divorced twice. Really, why would this man flee? Well, again, some people believe Ray is a spy, and he returned to the motherland. To be perfectly honest, I find this suggestion silly, but the body not being found does lend it some legitimacy, perhaps just enough that we can still consider it. So, let's do that. Ray is a public official, a position which allows him access to sensitive information. But as evidenced by his track record in the job, his interactions are specifically based in prosecuting criminals ranging from pedophiles to drug dealers to murderers. The politics in which he engages are on a local level and never seemingly matters of national importance, specifically related to security. For us to believe Ray was a spy and not suicidal like his father and brother, we have to concede that a boy who grew up in Cleveland was convinced by foreigners in his ancestral homeland, whether family, friends, or strangers affiliated with the government, to become a traitor against his own country in a situation where he was already poised to have a great career and family, specifically because of that American lifestyle, and that it happened while he was pursuing a job related to prosecuting criminals. Why the hell would I believe Ray Grecar was a traitorous criminal with sensitive information related to spying on a work laptop? There's no evidence, not even circumstantial. It's purely speculative. We just don't have any reason to believe he's a spy. He did make 2 visits overseas to the motherland, so to speak, when he went to Slovenia as a younger man. Some people would like to believe he was radicalized while there, and that he returned with this anti-U.S. sentiment that led him to become a traitor against his own country, before leaving when the time came to retire, and he wouldn't have the same access to information anymore. But there's no evidence to support this. Nobody even suspected it prior to his disappearance. To be fair, Ray spoke some Russian and was supposedly fluent in Slovak. Yet the truth about such things is many Americans speak a second language with roots in their ancestry. And almost none of them are spies. Overwhelmingly, the most common reason for people to disappear from the face of the earth, never to be seen again, is because they're dead. Very few people run away to start new lives because they don't have to run away to do it. In fact, if you stay and face the music of whatever's bothering you, your chances of having a good life are astronomically better than if you run. If you examine such cases, ones where people run away to start a new life, what you learn is that those who actually benefit from that type of behavior are abuse victims who are afraid to leave, but finally do. When you have something physically chasing you in the material world, running often seems the right choice. The same goes emotionally. But what's important to note is that people who run away from responsibility don't have better lives. It's people who run away from oppression who achieve that result. Those who run from responsibility look over their shoulders physically and emotionally. Only those experiencing distress from a tangible source ever escape what haunts them. So emotionally, we create distance from our problems in the only way we can. We try to block them out. If we can't do so through traditional means, such as diet, exercise, medication, and so on, we resort to substance abuse. If that fails, the only reliable method remaining is suicide. I would love for somebody to explain to me how an unmarried guy who's charming with the ladies, popular in town, and never going to be poor due to a pension, is going to be better off faking his death, abandoning his family, especially his daughter, and starting a new life in the absence of those resources. Whatever money he managed to save since his position went full-time in 1996 is not going to pay out nearly as much as his pension over time. And I'm supposed to believe he's in Slovenia, living a cushy life off spy money from his service, having fully succumbed to the desire to return to the motherland? No. It's fantasy. Misdirection in the case tells us everything. This event was perpetrated by Ray. He's never confirmed to have been seen again. Not here, or anywhere overseas. Okay, so I've been all over the place here introducing the facts, motivation, etc. But now I want to create a narrative based upon Ray's misdirection. Because here's the truth. Each instance of misdirection means he's hiding something he doesn't want us to see, in favor of showing us something that's the mirror image of that emotional value. Ray can't hide from me by doing that. So let's map it out. In terms of available evidence, and to our knowledge, Ray started planning this event when he searched for a map of Lewisburg on his home computer leading up to the day of his disappearance, which, of course, happened in that same area. He allows us that information. Or, I should say, allows the police that information. So that's perfectly straightforward. He hasn't tried to fool us. But he later tells his employer, in addition to his girlfriend, that he spontaneously decided to take the day off to relax, go for a drive, and check out some antique stores. In summary, what we see is that Ray lied to his girlfriend and employer about the spontaneity of his intentions that day, but intentionally allowed the truth on the back end when the police checked the hard drive. Otherwise, if he wanted everything to be a secret, he would have performed that online search on the laptop he destroyed, not his home computer. The logic is fairly simple. So what we can conclude is that Ray was willing to divulge where he was going that day, but was unwilling to tell his employer or girlfriend what he was really doing. That's the first instance of misdirection. Ray lies about his spontaneity. He makes this day off appear as a last-minute idea, telling his girlfriend he's, quote, playing hooky. But he's been planning something, and doesn't want anyone to know what it is. That's a fact. So his next move is going to be to ditch a laptop and hard drive. Notice that he doesn't perform that search on the laptop that gets wiped. He does it on his home computer. What this means is that Ray wanted us to know, or at least think, that the hard drive needed to be wiped due to sensitive information. But why would he tell us that? Why wouldn't he just search for how to wipe a hard drive on the laptop and then ditch the thing? That way, nobody would know he wiped it first. In fact, nobody would even know it's missing because of him. It would seem likely there was outside interference. But he makes sure we know he wiped it. Because he wants us to believe there's info on the hard drive related to his disappearance, things pointing to foul play, or leaving to start a new life. That's the misdirection. Don't buy his bullshit. Trust me on this one. He even reportedly asked at least one coworker how to do it. He was putting it in their heads, in the same way he allowed the police to find that information in the aftermath of his disappearance. The sensitive information on Ray's laptop is likely everything related to his disappearance that points directly to suicide. He allowed us everything that didn't, and the end result is what he intended. Confusion. Notice that the only time he allows suicide to be suggested in the narrative, in the form of parking by the bridge, when his own brother died from leaping off a bridge, is quickly nullified by the absence of a body and presence of cigarette ash in the car. So much misdirection takes place at the bridge. But what really happened on a bridge? His brother killed himself, and he couldn't accept that the man would do that to his kids. Fast forward to press conferences in the aftermath of Ray's disappearance, and guess who's the one person who seems crushed by the loss? His daughter. She's beside herself in the videos. You can literally see her pain. He knew he was going to be doing this to her, and refused to allow her the truth because he felt so strongly about not abandoning your kids in favor of killing yourself. He was a stay-at-home dad during those early formative years while his wife was out working. He clearly would have developed a bond with her. That's why he's unable to bring himself out of denial when it comes to his brother's suicide. He raised a child who, for whatever reason, was unwanted or unable to be cared for by her biological parents. He was the antithesis of the person he became, the opposite of his brother. And the misdirection comes as a result of not being willing to let the truth be known that things changed, that he came to understand why the others committed suicide, despite their children. Because the bottom line is that Ray's father did the same to Ray that he couldn't believe his brother would do to his kids. Why couldn't he believe it? It makes no sense. The truth is that he didn't want to believe it, because it suggested that he was that person too. I'm going to give you a personal example of how that plays out. My grandfather, specifically my mother's father, gassed himself in his car in the garage when she was a young adult, and the woman was simply never the same after that. Something terrorized her at every moment of every day until she became an alcoholic on the path to suicide, just like her dad before her. And people in my family would suggest that what was wrong with her was the fallout from the suicide. Finding him, seeing that terrible sight, watching him decline before that. But it wasn't true. What really bothered her is that she knew she was just like him, as evidenced by the fact it played out that way, despite too many trips to detox and rehab to count. There was no stopping it. She'd suffer the same fate. Of course, she did. She actually replicated the situation by committing suicide and having her youngest child, who was then a young adult, find her afterward. That's what her father did to her, and that's what she did to me. I always knew I'd be saddled with that responsibility, even by the time I was 8 years old. So I asked myself, is this me too? Will I succumb to this terror? I was a sophisticated little dude. These things occurred to me even back then. And my assessment was that, from a genetic standpoint, specifically emotional disposition, my personality seemed to be a perfect 50-50 split of each parent's influence. I engaged my mother's eternal dread as often as I displayed my father's intellectual reasoning. So I understood that I would suffer like her emotionally, but with a greater capacity for understanding the problem. I would express my pain and dissect it rather than mask it through alcohol and ultimately suicide. And that's exactly what happened. In a family tree ridden with alcoholics, I knew I wasn't one by the time I was in third grade, even before I'd ever taken a drink. And the reason is simple. My grandmother on my father's side was a writer and a poet. I got those genes too. Analytical thinking and art have kept me afloat for a long time while living inside a mind partially plagued with the hopelessness my mother bestowed upon me. And that's a scary thought. We're no more or less than the sum of our parts. That fight has been going on in my head my entire life. And by default of the genetic factors involved, there's no winner. Ever. I will always be that person. And guess when I stopped beating myself up about it, when I admitted it was true? The answer is the moment I let go of pride. When I refused to be dishonest. Ray can't let go of pride. He thinks suicide is an evil act against other people. His own father kills himself, and he won't believe his brother followed suit. Why? Again, because if it's true, he's next. And guess what? He is. It happens. Suicide is release from an emotional prison in which you're the only inmate. It's the result of deciding to forego unbearable emotional isolation and sadness. Very few people who take their own lives make any concessions for other people's feelings or even their future well-being. And the reason is they're not capable. My grandfather didn't do it for my mother. My mother didn't do it for me. And the reality in both of these situations is that the child in question was clearly the respective parent's favorite. It was no secret my mother favored me over my sibling, and it was also widely known her father adored her above and beyond her brother. But in their deaths, they made no concessions that prevented us from the horrible images that would be forever imprinted upon our imaginations. These were good people. My mother was very kind and thoughtful toward others, and her father was noted for the same. But here they are killing themselves in situations where these people they love the most are not only going to be totally crushed by it, but also suffer the visual imagery as well. If you love someone so dearly, why the hell would you put them through such a horrifying situation? And the answer, the one that Ray couldn't understand when his father went, or even his brother, the one that led him to this silly charade, is this. The truth is better. Always. Notice that there is no truth in the way Ray disappeared. There is only mystery. It's because he refuses to reveal the truth, and the other options are simply lies. So what does he do? He leaves all of those doors open, with nothing inside the room to see when you enter. And it's because the truth resides elsewhere. And in this case, the truth amounts to one thing. Ray's body, alive or dead. Ray Grecar is the person who initiates the actions that lead to misdirection. He employs it in this event before he goes missing. Why should I believe somebody else is at the wheel controlling things instead, during and after the disappearance? The speculative introduction of outside interference is unwarranted in this case. We don't have a single shred of evidence to support the presence of another human being. The police haven't even once suggested they collected anyone else's DNA from Ray's vehicle in connection to the cigarette smoker. And why? Because they didn't. I'm not putting a big, burly, bearded Hell's Angel smoking a cigarette while holding Ray hostage in the front seat of his Mini Cooper, because it sounds as ridiculous as it is. Violence committed by criminal organizations, or organizations perceived as criminal in some way, are carried out to send a message. There isn't one here. There is only confusion, misdirection, and hiding. There is absolutely no value or meaning to be extracted here, not even a simple eye for an eye message. He's not found burning in his car with a bullet in his head. The only person with any connection to the notion of an abandoned car with ash on the front passenger side floor is Ray Grecar. That was an element from the novel 2020, which included a fake death, a novel for which Ray was a consultant, and also featured a storyline that took place in three different eras, yet each segment happens on the same date, April 15th. Ray disappears on April 15th. So when the author approached him regarding the idea of writing a book about the unsolved Betsy Aardsma murder at Penn State in 1969, one in which she wanted to name the likely killer without getting sued, Ray told her to just fictionalize some of the elements while remaining true to her original intention. Look what happens in his disappearance. There are many false leads, but no matter what the truth is, the intention of leaving and never returning is achieved. Due to the truth not being palatable for those he leaves behind, he changes it to accommodate them, just as he recommends to the author. In both cases, it works. There's no benefit to behaving like this if you're an outside party engaging in foul play. Misdirection doesn't work because police investigate all the possibilities. In this case, it's been determined that Ray was either murdered, killed himself, or ran away to start a new life. All of those possibilities were looked at by detectives. Just look what's missing. Ray and his laptop. And how is the laptop destroyed? By water. Submerged in it. How is the hard drive destroyed? In water. How did Ray's brother die? Submerged and water. Where is the Mini Cooper found? Next to a bridge over water. So where is Ray Grecar most likely located? Underwater. But if he utilized his misdirection right from the start, what does that clearly tell us? Ray is not in the water under the bridge, or downstream. But he is underwater, and he's dead. Like his brother, and the laptop, the psychology says he's dead. His brother erased the past that way. Ray erased the past on his laptop's life by throwing it in the water. Its memory was gone. In fact, aside from searching online for how to destroy his hard drive, we know Ray also specifically searched for how to destroy a hard drive in water. He's likening his conscience to a computer simply because that's what it is. A human brain replicated as a machine. So his laptop contains the pain of his past in the same way his mind does. Yet it's a material item in the same way his flesh and blood body appears in the physical world. So in order to be free of the past, he needs to throw the laptop in a place where a human brain would be equally prone to death as his laptop's hard drive. And he chooses to throw it in water. But notice this. The hard drive is the computer's brain. But the rest of the laptop, the shell, is the body where the actions resulting from its processes take place. When people seek to commit suicide, the physical equivalent of what they seek emotionally is literally separating the body from the mind. But in order to do so, the machine has to die. That's the point. We watch Ray make plans to drive somewhere, at which point he separates the mind and body of the laptop by throwing it in water. Notice that he literally disposes of the laptop and hard drive in the same body of water, but away from each other. His brother was found like that, dead in the water, with his body separated from his conscious mind. None of this is necessary to run away and start a new life. He could just go. If in fact he has a place to hide that's so secret that he's managed to remain free of being identified in the last 13 plus years, why the hell didn't he just go there? Why bother with the setup? If he just left, we wouldn't be any more or less ignorant right now. But he doesn't. He uses misdirection when it's not required. What it means is that he's paranoid we're going to see the truth in a linear narrative. He doesn't know why he's worried about this consideration, and he doesn't possess the insight into the psychology of what he's doing. But his brain recognizes the symbolism of ditching the laptop in water and how it compares to his brother's death. So Ray is compelled to deceive us, but doesn't quite know how. He's not compelled to take these actions on a rational level. So he creates physical confusion and sends us in various directions chasing the truth. I'm not following. You can throw that bone, but this dog ain't fetching it, because the psychology of his actions tells us what he's really thinking. He's thinking of separating mind and body by drowning in a place beneath the surface where he won't be found. Get out the emotional mirror again and ask this question. When do people commit suicide? The answer? When they feel like they're drowning emotionally. They can't go on in that body while having those thoughts in that mind. What's the solution? Separation of those elements is key. And what is the mirrored image that results? You drown yourself physically, regardless of how, to compensate emotionally. That's what's going on in Ray's head. We know he planned the day trip. We know he lied. We know he searched online for how to wipe a hard drive. He was interested in water, and he misdirected the intended perception of his actions. Those are things confirmed as happening in his home or car, and on his computer. We can suggest somebody else performed the searches, yet there's no evidence. He's overwhelmingly the most likely person to have done it. But if you break down all of this piece by piece, you see all of the misdirection is related to the presence of water. Even when he searches for how to fry a laptop, the obvious answer is to put it in water while powered on, aka alive. It's how his brother kills himself, and how Ray insinuates he might have died too. So when we reach the end of the line on Ray's presence being known, where are we? Next to water. And what happens right there that doesn't happen elsewhere? Ray introduces the possibility of a second person utilizing foul play. He places cigarette ash in the car. Notice that Ray didn't smoke, hated smoking, and would never let anybody smoke in his car. It's the mirrored image of his emotional disposition regarding the matter. He's clearly saying, see, it's not me. But what do mirrors do? They redirect light. And Ray's emotional mirror is causing him to give himself away. The psychology says Ray would be the one motivated to turn our attention away from the water and toward a perpetrator other than him being the culprit. Ray is the only one who has falsely redirected light up until this point. On his computer, with a phone call to the office, in lying to his girlfriend. It's him. This is the bottom line. Ray lied about his activities that day. Why should we make a concession for his disappearance being anything other than what it seems? He was aging, retiring, broke, held no assets, was sleeping a lot, took days off to isolate himself from others, and lived in denial about his brother's tragic death. Ray clearly wasn't planning a future. He had already decided to leave his career. People who knew him said he was looking forward to his retirement. Please, that's nothing less than total bullshit. His pension couldn't keep him alive, despite being the one solid reason, at least financially, that he'd want to stick around. Beyond that, I'm supposed to believe he's in Slovenia, speaking variations of Slovak and Russian, in joyous celebration of a wonderful retirement back home in the motherland? No. Let's go on our own road trip here for a moment. With Ray, we're going to see a Cleveland Indians game. So, down the home stretch of Ray's career as DA, specifically after the announcement he planned to retire, I mentioned that he began to take days off here and there to do things like antique shopping or going for a scenic ride in his car. It seems really innocent with his upcoming retirement, almost reminiscent of the time you were a high school senior, enjoying those last days of not caring about class with summer looming on the horizon. But with the end result being what it is, that's just not what I see. What I see is a man who's ready to go, who's had enough of going to this job every day, even before retirement. He wants to get away from everything, and the farther the better. One day Ray goes to a Cleveland Indians game alone, and without telling anyone. It's a 3-hour game, at a 4-hour drive in either direction. That's 11 hours before accounting for time he stopped to get gas, eat, or use the restroom. He doesn't visit anyone there. He just goes to the game and back. But I think what we should notice is that he went back to his childhood, where he grew up. For a man who was 60 years old in 2005, he would have grown up in an era when baseball was at the top of the sporting heap in the United States. Of course, he grew up in Cleveland as an Indians fan, so this game has quite a bit of sentimental value, as does the city. And that's the last time he goes to an Indians game. Now, reconsider how innocent it is that he went alone and told no one, only to never go again. This was all about him, about reflection, on the past, on his pain, on the things we only do away from the prying eyes of our family and friends. He went back to a time when it was all fun and games. When he was a kid, before his father killed himself, before his brother did too. But he turned his car around afterward and returned to the place from which he came. He went back to the suffering. He went back to what life was, rather than what he wanted it to be. And he did it for one reason. The past is gone. Forever. You can't win it back. Neither could Ray, no matter the outcome of the game. And I say this because I remember having my own version of that game. Right after going through a terrible breakup with my fiancé, I was hit really hard by loneliness. But I didn't want to be with anybody else yet. I just wanted to be alone. Yet that's what was causing my suffering. I felt like I just needed to get away for the day. What immediately came to mind is that I should drive a few hours in each direction to a casino and gamble. At the time, I didn't give any consideration to why I specifically chose to go there. I just went. I played blackjack all day and lost. It was awful, truly. So I left and did so in a bad state of mind. But not too long after that, I did it again. I went back. And again, I lost everything I came with and left even more miserable. In fact, I even went a third time. Yet this is when I finally learned a lesson. Though, not because I lost. I won. Maybe close to $900. And I thought to myself, this is great. Now get out of here before you lose it. So I did. I went and got something to eat. But my happiness quickly waned as I sat there by myself reflecting on what just happened. Despite the fact that I won, something just didn't sit right with me. I kept going over it in my mind and contemplated it on the way to the car. In the parking garage, I passed a young couple laughing and holding hands on their way into the casino. There was nobody else around. For some reason, I stopped and looked back at them, like they were familiar, which was strange because I didn't know them. Then I went back to the car. I got in and took the cash out of my pocket to count it, paranoid I might have dropped something. But it didn't bring happiness. In fact, I was overwhelmed with emotion. Sadness, emptiness, loneliness. How could this cash make me feel like that? And suddenly the truth hit me. I suffered such a profound loss that I drove to the casino to try to compensate by winning. But I learned, as did Ray Grecar, that the past is gone. You can't win it back. Not at the Cleveland Indians game, not at the casino, or anywhere else for that matter. It only lives in your mind. And for that reason, you can't escape it. Not ever. Also for that reason, whether we're talking about Ray Grecar, Ryan Kraus, or you, we have to turn the car around and go back. That's what Ray did. I did too. I can't say how it was for him, but I drove home pondering my life, especially the nature of the loss I experienced. I soon came to realize something had to be done. I had to rebuild, or I had to give up. It was a choice. But unlike Ray, I chose to live. Because I had a future, I was young. There was so much time and so little cynicism. No matter how bad things got, I could change. I could prosper. A career was ahead of me. My dreams. There was so much to look forward to. I believed I could find love again. Sometimes it's enough to get us by on our worst moments. But Ray was at the end of his career and didn't have anything to show for it. He'd been through 2 divorces. His daughter was grown. If I try to put myself in his shoes, I think I might have felt differently about my own decision to stick it out through tough times. He was decades older than I was. Maybe he just got tired of it. We all have those moments. But when you string enough of them together, you start to welcome anything that even remotely offers the promise of peace. And if you look more closely at that idea, what you notice is that young people fear death far more than their elderly counterparts, that the party set to face the music is the one at peace with the sound of imminent death knocking at their door. Young people are the victims in horror movies, and they comprise most of the audience, because they so greatly fear death. With age, people come to accept it, and it's because we naturally decline in the process of the years passing us by. Young people haven't begun to decline, and therefore have no understanding of mortality from that vantage point. Death is always unwelcome for them. They run from it, because they have the future. It's that simple. They have a lot to look forward to. I think Ray was depressed. I think he had been for a long time. He dealt with it, but only until it just seemed like it wasn't worth it anymore. Then he cashed out. My mother did this. Her father did too. Ray's father did this. So did his brother. Because they were tired and perpetually tortured, they didn't want to continue. We can offer a million excuses for why somebody has committed suicide, but it always boils down to one thing. They couldn't deal with life. There's a shame in that. We're designed to avoid suicide at all costs. To this day, it remains taboo and illegal. So when I look at this situation, I can't see any need for Ray Grigar to run away to start a new life. His career was ending. He wasn't married. He could have done whatever the hell he wanted. And I don't see evidence of abduction or foul play of any kind. Ray wanted his laptop to disappear that day. He wanted to erase its past, essentially killing it in water by separating its body from its mind in the form of the shell from the hard drive. It disappears. Then he does the same. I have no reason to believe the cause was anything but suicide. The police tend to lean in that direction as well, while also admitting the absence of a body is problematic. However, there's nothing that dictates Ray went into the water. He had ample time to plan his exit, and I believe that while his primary goal was to end the pain of his existence, what was nearly as important to him was to prevent his family, police, and the general public from learning he'd succumbed to suicide. We don't know where Ray went that day, other than a place he thought he'd never be found. He's doing a pretty good job of keeping the secret so far. Only time will tell if that continues, or if the truth will surface, whether that means his body from the ocean, or his grainy image going viral on social media when a tourist spots him overseas. With no sign of him at all, I believe Ray Grigar is dead. With no direct evidence of foul play, I believe his disappearance was voluntary. And without evidence of Ray living elsewhere having ever surfaced, I believe that voluntary disappearance was successfully carried out, and the intention was suicide. What compels me to believe this so strongly is the narrative that Ray didn't want to hurt other people. Notice that there's nothing truly upsetting or disturbing about his disappearance, other than the fact that he's gone and he never comes back. The circumstances offer nothing more than a hint, just a dash of potential truth. We don't see blood, damage to the car's interior, Ray's phone smashed, torn clothing, or anything that would cause great alarm because of its visceral nature. Everything is suggestive, painted with very delicate brushstrokes, and for a very careful effect. And the effect I clearly see is that the perpetrator didn't want to upset anyone beyond what was absolutely necessary to keep everybody else guessing forever. He didn't want them to feel the pain of believing he committed suicide, or even the dread of learning about evidence that suggests he was probably murdered. In the end, there's only the hurt that he's gone for those left in his wake. As long as there's no body, they can never attach their emotions to anything but mystery. And of all people, who is the person most likely to want to achieve that result? Ray Grecar. The guy who couldn't believe his brother killed himself when what happened? When his body surfaced and his family learned he left them to commit suicide. Look how this ends up. We can't prove it's suicide, and we don't have a body. It's the mirrored image of what his brother did. And look what happens then. He literally separates his body from our minds as well. We never know his fate. And guess what that means? His family doesn't suffer the shame of a public suicide like his brother's family endured. The psychology of this case points to Ray Grecar as being the sole perpetrator. But nothing points to the cause of death or the location of his body. At least, for now. And I think maybe that's exactly how he would have wanted it. The traditional thinking is that most suicide victims want to be found. Ray had reason to not be. And it got me to thinking about a conversation I had with my father when I was a kid, maybe 8 years old. We were talking about a friend of his who had died in a car accident involving alcohol, a younger man with two little daughters he tragically left behind. He couldn't have been more than 31 years old at the time, and his daughters were no older than 3 or 4. They were our neighbors from across the street, and I remember their sadness well. I remember the looks on the girls' faces. They seemed hurt and abandoned, unsure what to do. There was no escaping the fact their father got drunk and drove his car to his death one night, never to return. It was terribly sad, but what I remember most was the whispers, the rumors, and how his wife kept the kids close by her side and mostly indoors afterward. The smiles were gone, along with the laughing. The kids didn't even play across the street anymore. Soon enough, we never saw them at all. They stayed inside. But you could still feel that energy. The suffering. The pain. The constant what-ifs. Soon after that, they moved. And I don't know where they went, but I know it followed. The memories, the heartache, all the things that can't be reconciled with time. And I know that because it's happened to me too. The dead haunt my dreams. They live in the spiritual world of my soul, lurking, watching, waiting to hurt me. When Ray's family looks back in the same way, that emotional house of horrors is empty. They still know it's there, but they never have to experience what's inside. Mystery is nothingness. It's a question, possibility, potential, confusion, curiosity. But it is never an answer. It is never the truth. So how do we find that in this case? If we can't do so physically, by locating Ray's body, how do we do it emotionally? Well, I think the answer was at the end of this conversation I had with my father. after talking about his friend dying so young, and expressing our own desires to live long lives, I asked my dad how he'd like to go, if he had the privilege of choosing. And you might think he said, with his family by his side, tucked comfortably under the sheets of a hospital bed, where he would be offered the most comfort possible in his final days. But he didn't say anything like that, not even to please me as his young son, who would wonder why he'd rather be elsewhere than with me. I didn't stop his explanation, though. I just listened. And what he told me is that he would like to just walk off into the Sierra Mountains one day and drop dead, alone and without plans for burial. As a young boy, I immediately found that very sad. I could only let out a nervous laugh in response. But I remembered that conversation well and reflected on it in later years. What eventually occurred to me is that he didn't want to be remembered as a corpse in a hospital bed. He wanted to be remembered for who he was when he was young. He loved to climb those mountains. What greater freedom would there be than to die there and become a part of them physically? I thought of this, of standing in front of a vast mountain range, in all its natural beauty, wondering where he might have gone. In the same way we could stand on a bridge overlooking the Susquehanna River, pondering the fate of Ray Grecar. And it occurred to me that the mystery of where the missing have gone is also the mystery of where we come from. We enter this world alone, and for reasons we can't quite understand. The emotional mirror tells us we must therefore also leave this existence alone, and for a purpose we'll never know. But in the meantime, there's a road we travel, whether over a bridge, in a Mini Cooper, or on a highway leading to a casino. No matter the route you take, this path leads from the beginning of consciousness to the end, never stopping until it reaches one particular destination. Mystery. We always want to know one thing. What happens next? In this story, as in the human lifespan, we still don't know the answer. And somewhere, right at this moment, whether overseas in a secret hiding spot, or looking down from high above in the heavens, Ray Grecar is grinning wildly at all of us. Strangely enough, I have no doubt he would have wanted it this way. Something tells me we do too.